I have been catching up on my Ken Burns here recently, courtesy of WKAR-TV. Maybe you have as well. I didn't see all of the jazz documentary the first time it aired, or maybe even the second time it aired. I'm not proud to admit that, but we've been re-airing some of those the last few days on WKAR-TV, and ironically, all of that comes ahead of Ken Burns' new documentary, Jackie Robinson, a two-parter that begins tonight at 9 o'clock on WKAR-TV. It comes courtesy of PBS, of course. And later this hour, we will talk with current sports Al Martin, who has a guest who can tell us a lot about Jackie Robinson. That is later this hour, and then again on Current Sports with Al Martin later today on AM 870 WKAR. So more Ken Burns tonight on WKAR-TV. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State. I'm glad you're along here for Monday. What is life like in a city where tap water is toxic? That's the question we will explore in our Faces of Flint series, produced in partnership with Michigan State University journalism students. All this week, we're bringing you the stories of Flint residents as they navigate day-to-day life in the midst of the city's water crisis. Today, we meet hip-hop artist, activist, and inspirational speaker Mama Soul. She was born and raised in Flint and says her music is a voice for the voiceless. Mama Soul's quest to bring the community together through hip-hop became even more important as the water crisis unfolded. MSU journalism student Maria Braganini brings us her story.
Now we come in peace with the intent to increase and restore hope for the hopeless, and love is the focus. I pray that this message will reach far beyond them clouds, God. We need you involved now. Your spirit is needed.
These are the words that Flint hip-hop artist Mama Soul kept repeating to herself when she heard about the extent of the water crisis in Flint. In the wake of revelations that residents had been drinking lead-tainted water for nearly a year and a half, she did what she always does. She put it into a song.
That would flow into the ghetto without warning, that the poison that was pouring through the metal had no control of corrosion. Hold up. But you hoped that we wouldn't notice. But thank you, Dr. Mona. Respect, Virginia Tech, for putting Flint on your shoulders and did it with no regret. Man, that water was brown. It reeked like rotten eggs. Our babies can't bathe, but the bill gotta be paid.
I meet Mama Soul in the main lobby of the New Jerusalem Gospel Church on a Saturday afternoon.
You gonna come see me perform? Okay. I love you. Okay. I'll see you in a minute. Okay.
She's wearing jeans and a black t-shirt with the words Flint Lives Matter printed in thick white letters across her chest. Mama Soul is here to perform for Hip Hop for Flint, a series of nationwide benefit concerts for the city's residents. It's not surprising Mama Soul is here. She grew up in Flint, and the people here are quick to tell you how much of a fixture she is in the community. Flint resident Sharae Rasborough.
She's a big inspiration and a positive reinforcement for our city, and also a positive light for the residents of the city of Flint. She gives that extra bit of hope and extra bit of inspiration to each one. She gives us, like I said, that positivity that we need in this time of a crisis for us.
Mama Soul, in turn, is quick to tell you that it was the community that inspired her to write a song about the lead in the water.
You know, so many people, of course, are asking, like, oh, I know you're going to write something about the water crisis. I know you got something coming for us. And when the people start requesting something from me, I know they need it.
Mama Soul has released 3 albums, 2 mixtapes, and a total of 75 published songs. But she says Hard to Swallow was the toughest she's ever written.
And I cried every single day during that writing process, 2-3 times. There were several times I just broke down and had to just stop. Go do something else. Go outside, walk around, get some fresh air, and come back to it. You know, so it took some time for me to write it, over a week, which is a long time for me.
Mama Soul was born in the city in the late 1970s. She was raised by her mother, a Catholic school teacher. Mama Soul says she had a wonderful childhood. From an early age, she was encouraged to try everything and become whatever she wanted.
I was a kid that did archery, basketball, saw whatever it was, I tried it. From cake decorating to, you know, whatever. So we had a wonderful childhood. Flint taught us well.
But she also saw the seedier side of Flint. Mama Soul says her dad dealt drugs and was in and out of prison for most of her childhood.
Then I would be at my father's in the summer, and You know, it's a totally different scene. You know, drugs on a table and 8-bedroom house, big swimming pool. You know, people have a lot of money and people give you money coming and going, and it's totally different. So I was able to see both sides. I saw the hustle and I saw the love.
But still, her memories are mostly positive, like the one she has of summer nights spent in downtown Flint, watching the 4th of July fireworks.
The entire city seemed like it was downtown and there weren't any problems. Your parents could tell you, okay, come back here once the fireworks are done, come back to this spot. And you could go run free. And it was fun. And I mean, our entire neighborhood would walk downtown to the fireworks together with our parents.
Mama Soul left Flint after high school, but she moved back home in 2009 after giving birth to her son, Wasir. 2 years later, she volunteered in Kenya to help tribes suffering from drought in the Horn of Africa. She says she remembers people dying of dehydration and feeling privileged that she lived in a country where water was safe and abundant.
And I went to my hotel room one night and I wrote a song called Thankful. And the first line of that song, I said, I'm thankful for the fact that I can turn on a tap and have fresh water. First line of the song. And now I'm in the United States and I feel like I'm in a third world country where I wrote the song. So making that correlation for me is what gives me the energy to get up every day and see what and help where I can.
When Mama Soul heard the city was switching its water source to the Flint River, she was stunned. She remembers the day the toxic water was finally confirmed. She immediately went to get herself and her son tested. Both had been drinking only filtered water. Mama Soul had no traces of lead in her blood. But Wasir's blood levels tested positive for the toxic metal, just from breathing and bathing in the water. Mama Soul was devastated, and she was angry at the government officials who let this happen.
And I never thought this was a mistake. There was never a moment inside of me. My instinct told me that this was intentional.
All around her, Mama Soul saw her friends and family struggle with weight loss and seizures. That's when she wrote Hard to Swallow.
I mean, I had a friend of mine text me after I released it and was like, yo, thank you so much for that. Because I had my children tested. My youngest has high lead levels and all my other ones have low lead levels. And I'm so glad that song helped me so much.
Mama Soul sees hip hop as an opportunity to reach out to the community. She says her voice isn't just making music. It's making social change.
If we could only start using hip-hop as a tool to educate and to uplift each other and stop tearing each other down and stop putting these false images of who we really are out into the world, we could change the world through music.
But that change won't come soon enough for Mama Soul. As she plans for her future, she sees Flint in her rearview mirror. The reason why?
Come on, dab again for
me. I'm done with that.
Come on, stop. Mm-hmm.
Mama Soul wants her son Wasir to be able to grab a drink from the faucet. She doesn't want to have to worry about the air he's breathing or the water he's using to brush his teeth. And she's not sure she can make a living in this cash-strapped city either.
There is not enough currency flowing through Flint to keep me surviving and living through the crisis day to day and still be able to do the work that I do and be able to live the life that I desire to live.
But even if she leaves town, Mama Soul says she'll always be a light in Flint.
And when the people here need me that know how to get to me because I know that they're aligned and vibrating on the same frequency as me, I'll appear. It doesn't matter where I get my mail.
For Current State, I'm Maria Bragnini.
The brightest star, the hardest fight.
This piece was edited by Current State producer April Van Buren. Tomorrow on Faces of Flint, we meet a family who's weary of Flint's image in the media and says news coverage of the city is overlooking vibrant businesses and developments there.
You just have to say, no, it's not a bad place. Like when people ask you, oh, you live in Flint? I'm so sorry. You live in a good spot. You live in a good area.
And documentary video shorts from our Faces of Flint series can be seen immediately following the PBS NewsHour all week on WKAR-TV. You can also find all of our coverage from the series on WKAR.org. Faces of Flint is jointly produced by MSU journalism students studying with Professor Jerry Alumet-Zeldis and the Current State staff. Coming up on Current State, red oak trees can turn a beautiful fiery shade every autumn, but sadly some of those trees die in the middle of summer because of an invasive species. Oak wilt disease is spreading through forests in parts of northern Michigan, but it can be managed. We'll talk with a forester and an invasive species expert about the problem. This week, MSU Science Festival will focus on STEAM, the STEAM subjects to be more precise, science, technology, engineering, the arts, and math. The cluster of subjects has got more attention in recent years because American employers commonly struggle to fill technical jobs involving science. The MSU Science Festival includes events beginning this week in East Lansing and all next week in Detroit, demonstrations, expo zones, and astronomy night. Our next guest will deliver the festival's opening address tomorrow night at Wharton Center. Dr. Brian Green is a renowned physicist and author who teaches at Columbia University. His presentation, Stories from the Frontiers of Discovery, is about innovation, exploration, and discovery. I spoke with Brian Green and asked him what makes a successful science festival.
It's the quality of the programming. You need programming that feels nothing like the classroom, that allows kids and adults to have an experience of science that really can touch them emotionally, that can get them fired up, that doesn't feel like they're under the gun to memorize facts or take exams. It's really the joy and wonder of exploration.
Well, the New York Times has called the World Science Festival, of which you are a co-founder, a new cultural institution. I would take it that such a successful event embodies what you just described.
Well, we try, and we were certainly thrilled with that reaction from the Times and the reactions from many of the folks who've come to the festival. We have as a fixture of what we do a blending of art and science in many of the events that is unusual and allows for a kind of emotional impact of scientific ideas that you don't often get when you just go to a lecture or just go to a demonstration.
Would you say generally, Brian Green, that science has broad appeal in this country?
It's a good question, and it's a somewhat subtle one. I would certainly say that when science is brought out of the laboratory and provided to the public in a way that captures the true drama of exploration, when it really captures the wonder of discovery, when it's accessible, it doesn't make you feel like you can't get it. I just tell you, across the board, people love the kinds of ideas that science is engaged with. I mean, the fact that time slows down near a black hole, or that lengths squeeze when you go near the speed of light, or that particles can quantum tunnel through barriers, or this wonderful result just of 6-8 weeks ago of the detection of gravitational waves produced by two colliding black holes on the other side of the universe, it's hard to understand how you couldn't get excited about these things so long as you feel like you can get it.
The focus of your opening address tomorrow night at Wharton Center is titled The Drive to Innovate, Stories from the Frontiers of Discovery. And it focuses on the challenges scientists have faced when doing their work. I don't want to ruin your address by any means, but could you talk to us generally about the role of perseverance and courage in scientific discovery?
Well, it's huge, and Einstein is the wonderful example of that. You know, we are now in the 100th anniversary of his discovery of the general theory of relativity. It's a theory of how the force of gravity works. And Einstein was advised by friends and colleagues not to work on it, that he'd never cracked the problem. He was even told that even if you do make headway, nobody will believe the insights that you come to. And yet he had this internal compass where he knew where he wanted to go, and he pursued where that compass was directing him And in so doing, he changed our understanding of space and time and matter, energy, and the universe. So it's a wonderful story that will be the backbone of my remarks, where we follow this mind that starts off at Earth and ends up at the edge of the cosmos. Mm.
Dr. Brian Green is my guest. He'll be in East Lansing tomorrow evening to launch the 2016 MSU Science Festival. Dr. Green's a theoretical physicist, a co-founder of New York's World Science Festival, and the author of four books. He's also a professor of physics at Columbia University. Now, here at MSU's event, there's a focus on the STEAM curriculum, science, technology, engineering, the arts, and math. Is a focus on STEAM subjects a good thing?
I think it's a great thing. You know, there was a focus which initially began, as you may know, as STEM, without the A, which
right.
is the art side of things. And it's, I think, vital that we have a more holistic approach to the way we think about our explorations of the universe. I mean, scientists approach truth one way, artists approach truth in a different, but I consider allied way, and ultimately it's the insights of everybody that helps us have a deeper appreciation of the universe and our place within it.
Do American schools not emphasize STEAM subjects enough?
There are a lot of great teachers around this country, so I always am reluctant to generalize, but I have to say that when I talk to many kids around the country, as I do when I go around giving talks, many of them have no idea what science really is. They just think it's something about memorizing the facts that are in their textbook. They don't realize that science is about trying to figure things out, that it's puzzling through, it's battling against the universe, and when we're lucky, on rare occasion, we emerge on the other side with a spectacularly new understanding of things. So when I tell these kids about black holes and the Big Bang, and when they come to, say, pieces of mine that discuss those ideas melded with music and art, I have a piece with Philip Glass about a boy going to a black hole, so it's music and physics and space travel. When they attend performances like that, their view of science totally changes.
Is the bigger challenge in the schools, or is that a result? Are there perhaps too few offerings in the schools because too few young people are interested in those subject areas in the first place? It's kind of a chicken or egg question.
Yeah, the chicken and egg question is always a good one, but in the end of the day, school has such a vital and formative role in what kids are excited by, what they are interested in. And moreover, if you think in a multi-generational sense, when parents themselves go to school and they are not excited by science, then of course when they grow up, they don't communicate that excitement to their own children. So I think school is the vital place where this can change, and science festivals, be it the one in New York, be it the one happening in Michigan, can play a vital role because kids and adults can go together and re-experience what science is about.
You're a specialist in string theory, which our listeners have likely heard of at one time or another. Remind us, please, of the essence of string theory.
Well, string theory is an attempt to realize a dream that Albert Einstein himself had really for the last 30 years of his life. After he discovered the general theory of relativity, he wanted to go further and find what he called the unified theory. One theory, maybe one big equation that would explain everything in the universe, the big, the small, everything in between. Now, he never found the unified theory, and we don't know if we have it yet, but at least on paper, for the first time, we have a candidate, and this candidate is called string theory. So we're working very hard on the mathematics of this theory to try to connect it up to observation and experiment. We've not achieved that yet, but at least on paper, this theory has a chance. At least a chance of being the unified theory that Einstein looked for.
And walk us backward, if you would, maybe a step at a time here, from string theory back to Einstein. Before string theory, was there a scientific preoccupation here?
Sure.
Just before string theory, what was that?
Yeah, I mean, a good question. One way of thinking about it is Einstein's general relativity, since it is a theory of gravity, really matters when things are big. Stars, galaxies, the whole universe. And in that domain, the realm of the big, Einstein's math works incredibly well. But there was another theory being developed at around the same time that Einstein also participated in, which is called quantum mechanics. And that's a theory that describes molecules, atoms, subatomic particles, the really tiny stuff in the world. And for the small things, quantum mechanics does a great job as well. The weird thing is, when you look at the math of quantum mechanics and the math of general relativity, the equations don't compute. They don't work together. When you try to put the two theories together, it all falls apart. Now, we have one universe, so we should have one theory that embraces everything. And yet, when we try to put the laws of the big and the small together in any conventional way, it doesn't work. So the idea of string theory is to fix that problem, to come up with a framework that can put general relativity and the other theory, quantum mechanics, together into one coherent package.
Now, we tend to think of the greatest scientific discoveries happening maybe not all that often, but important smaller discoveries would appear to be happening much more often. Am I right to assume that?
Yeah, you're right. Unfortunately, you're right. I mean, we wish the big breakthroughs happened all the time. Every scientist dreams of having a big breakthrough. But you're right. For the most part, we make incremental progress. And that's really what the driving engine of science is about. I mean, a beautiful example is this discovery of the gravitational waves that you probably heard about, you know, these ripples in the fabric of space that just came out 2 months ago. That was the result of 50 years of research, 50 years of incremental progress in understanding the math, in building the equipment, in fashioning the detectors. There's now one in Louisiana and the other in Washington State. And these folks, many points along the way, could have given up, but they were encouraged by their own incremental progress, the baby steps that ultimately yields the major leap of understanding when the wave of gravity, this ripple in space, finally was detected.
Dr. Brian Green is my guest. He will be in East Lansing tomorrow evening to launch the 2016 MSU Science Festival. He's a theoretical physicist and the author of four books. You've appeared on Letterman, on Colbert, on Charlie Rose. The Washington Post called you the single best explainer of abstruse concepts in the world today. How do you view yourself in that role as a popularizer of science?
Well, I think it's vital for the ideas of science to not be locked away in academic journals or locked away in the ivory tower of the academy, because ultimately we're carrying forth a human journey that began with the explorers in, say, ancient Greece, Egypt, and so on, and everybody should be able to at least understand what's going on, even if they don't have the technical training to, say, participate in the research. So I see myself as a, first and foremost, as a scientist, a physicist, trying to push the boundaries of understanding, but I step outside of that role now and then to try to build a bridge. And it's very gratifying when I give a talk somewhere and some kid says to me, I'm now a graduate student in physics, and I went into physics because I read your book, The Elegant Universe, or I saw one of your television shows. It's gratifying. It also makes me feel very old, but that's just par for the course. So it's a wonderful thing when bringing science to the public can really inspire a kid to go forward and become a scientist.
I'm sure. My next question concerns that book, The Elegant Universe. What single feature of the universe contributes most to this elegance?
Well, the very fact that we're able to understand it. Einstein himself articulated that, I can't remember the exact quote, but something along the lines of, the most confusing or the most surprising feature of the universe is that it is intelligible. It didn't have to be the case that the human brain would be able to figure out how black holes work or even that they exist. It isn't necessarily the case that the human brain would be able to figure out how atoms and particles work, but it has. So it's a beautiful thing that we're endowed with a mind that can see patterns in the world and encapsulate those patterns in the language of mathematics. That is beautiful. That is elegant, that you can look at a few symbols on a piece of paper and they tell you something deep about how the world actually functions.
Here in Michigan, people have been learning more about particle acceleration because of Michigan State's impending FRIB, the Facility for Rare Isotope Beams. This would seem to be right up your alley.
Yeah, no, it's exactly the kind of work that has the potential to do what we're talking about, to have breakthrough understanding of our structure of matter and the laws that describe how particles and their conglomerates, atoms and molecules, how they all behave. And I think it's a vital thing that we're having this science festival at Michigan State, because ultimately it's got to be that the general public is excited by these kinds of experiments, because ultimately it's tax dollars which support this research. So in many ways, Science Festival in New York, the Science Festival in Michigan, can be viewed as a kind of status report to the general public, so that people can get excited about where this money is going and the boundaries of understanding that is being pushed, and in that way tell all of their representatives that we need to continue to support science.
Do you spend much time keeping up with other scientific areas besides physics? That's obviously your bread and butter there, but I mean...
Yeah, I try. I'm very much a layperson in other areas of science, but there's a lot of great stuff happening in neuroscience, a lot of great stuff happening in nanoscale science, great stuff happening in the arenas of quantum computing. Of course, big data is all the rage these days. So at a cultural level, I follow these developments.
Have you kept track of the science involved in the global warming discussion?
Not a whole lot. I've never actually investigated the data itself, but you know, my own view, looking at the graphs that everybody else in the general public can look at too, is it seems pretty convincing to me that humankind is having an impact on climate. And my own view, which I hope would be shared more widely, even by those who are skeptical, we have to err on the side of caution. We have to do what is right under the assumption of the worst case scenario. The Earth is a very precious place. You don't play games with that.
We had a guest last week who's associated with the Dark Sky Movement and who runs a dark sky park up in northern Michigan. And this is a long way of asking you if you're into astronomy.
You know, again, at a cultural level, I don't go out there in the field with my colleagues who do astronomical research, but you know, we don't see many stars in Manhattan. A clear starry night is when you see three stars in Manhattan. But we have a farm in upstate New York where it's dark and clear, and there's nothing like it. I mean, I often have felt that if everybody was to continuously, every evening, experience a deep, dark, starry sky, I just somehow feel that the life would be better.
Dr. Brian Green's been my guest. He will be in East Lansing tomorrow evening to help launch the 2016 MSU Science Festival. Dr. Green's a theoretical physicist, a co-founder of New York's World Science Festival, the author of four books, and is a professor of physics at Columbia University. Dr. Green, thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy your visit to Michigan State.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And coming up on Current State, spring football is here for the Spartans. We'll hear about what kind of shape the 2016 team is in. From Current Sports, Al Martin. That and more after the break on Current State. Current State comes your way 7 days a week on 90.5 WKAR or on AM 870 WKAR. Glad you could join us today. Despite our recent snow and chilly temperatures, many trees are starting to bud here in mid-Michigan. One particular species, the northern red oak, is worth a summer-long wait to see its leaves turn to a fiery shade in the fall. But this year, many red oaks in Michigan might not make it that long. Oak wilt disease is a fungal infection that turns leaves brown and kills off trees in midsummer. It's always fatal to the tree. Oak wilt disease has been found this spring across much of the northern lower peninsula. Here to talk about the effects of oak wilt disease are Ray Gurley. Ray is a forestry expert with Consumers Energy Hydroelectric Program. Welcome to the program, Ray.
Good to be here, Mark.
And returning to Current State, Dr. Deb McCullough, professor of entomology at Michigan State University. Deb, welcome back.
Thank you, Mark.
Ray Gurley, what happens to a red oak? What do we see when we see a red oak that's contracted oak wilt?
What we see in a red oak that's contracted oak wilt is wilting. It's the fungal disease clogs tyloses, which are small water-conducting pores that transport water from the roots to the leaves. And as these pores become clogged, the leaves wilt and will fall off. And a lot of the time, this happens during the greatest period of water demand on an oak tree. So early spring to midsummer is when we're going to see that wilting occur.
And go a little bit deeper with us on the cause here. What if this is a fungus?
Yeah, so this is a fungus. It's actually very closely related to Dutch elm disease, and it's vectored by, you know, two of the same means that Dutch elm disease, by root grafts and by small sap-beating beetles.
Are there areas of the state that are more affected here? Deb, can you answer that?
Well, I would say yes, there are. It's definitely spotty. It's been a problem in the Upper Peninsula for quite a while now, probably as bad as anywhere around the central part of the Upper Peninsula. And then it's been real spotty in Lower Michigan. And the problem is that once you have a tree that dies, and then as Ray said, the fungus can move from the dead tree into adjoining trees, and now you have more dead trees, and all of those trees are producing spores, which can blow in the air or be carried by the beetle. And so you end up with more and more inoculum, if you want to think of it that way, more spores. And gosh, we're seeing it on the west side of Lower Michigan, northern Lower Michigan, picking it up in some areas around Oakland County in the southeast. And it's not continuous, but we definitely have a bigger problem than we had even 5 or 10 years ago.
How controllable is this problem, Ray?
This problem can be controlled by not pruning from April through July, and that's probably the best thing that we can do. Other, you know, preventing the spread by not moving firewood, not transporting wood.
But the pruning's the heart logs. But the pruning is really the heart of the cure here.
The pruning is the crux of prevention that a landowner or, you know, an owner of a tree can.
And why is that? What is it about pruning that jeopardizes these trees?
So these wounds, these open fresh wounds on the oak tree, the sap beetles are attracted to that. The fungus, the spore pads crack open the bark on the bole of the tree, so on the trunk of the tree, and these sap beetles are attracted to the fruity, kind of stale beer smell that this fungus gives off. So they go down into these cracks, and they rub up against these spore pads and get spores through their scales and on their legs. And as they move to other fresh wounds on oak trees, whether it be pruning wounds or wounds from a lawnmower, wounds from construction equipment, they bring those spores with them and then transport spores to trees that have not been infected.
There's an insect that's at the heart of this, I guess, the picnic beetle.
Yes, picnic beetles, the name sounds so friendly and cheerful,
it does.
Doesn't it? they're not very
they're
big.
Killers, right?
Well, it's not their fault exactly. They are attracted to anything that smells sweet or sickly sweet. When we want to trap them, we'll take bananas and put them in a pie pan and pour beer over them. And if you think of what that would smell like in a few days, that's the kind of stuff they're attracted to. And they're not very large. They're maybe a little bit bigger than a ladybug, kind of longer, dark-colored with four yellow or orangish patches on the backside, and they want to feed on sap. And so as Ray said, when you have a tree, an oak tree, that's been killed by oak wilt disease, we call it a fungal mat, and it pushes through the bark, and the beetles really want to feed on that. And so they do, and then they fly off to a healthy tree, and maybe they feed, maybe a branch broke in a windstorm, or maybe, like Ray said, there's been some construction damage, and that fungus will move off of the beetle, get into the tree, and the trees are really vulnerable in May and June, because that's when they're producing early wood. If you think about a tree, and if you've ever looked at a fresh stump, you see bands of light-colored wood and then dark wood alternating back and forth. And so when a tree grows and puts wood on in May and June, it's making early wood. And those vessels are big, and a lot of water moves through those vessels. And somewhere around the end of June, middle of July, they switch and produce latewood. And the latewood vessels are much smaller, and they have very thick cell walls, and that's why it looks dark when you look at a tree ring. And so what tree rings are is early wood, late wood, early wood, late wood. Mm. And the fungus can infect the early wood because you have these great big vessels. The fungus gets in there. The fungus starts to grow in the water-conducting vessels, these big vessels in the wood, and that's what plugs up the ability of the tree to transport water. And so if a tree can't move water from the roots to the leaves, like Ray said, the leaves start to wilt. And all of this is going to be happening in May and June, and boy, you don't want to attract beetles. The best way to deal with this pathogen is not to have it come into your woodlot or into your yard.
We're talking about an outbreak of oak wilt disease in parts of Michigan here this spring. It's mainly happening in the northern counties of the Lower Peninsula here. I see Grand Traverse, Leelanau, Kalkaska, and Benzie counties, I guess. Our guests are Deb McCullough, professor of entomology at Michigan State University, and Ray Gurley, a forestry expert with Consumers Energy's hydropower operations. Now, some species of trees are apparently more vulnerable than others. Well, here's my first question. How many different species of oak tree are there?
There are hundreds of different species of oak trees within Quercus around globally. But within Michigan, I would have to say around 25 to 30 species.
But some of those are more vulnerable than others.
Yeah, so oaks are broken into two groups, the genus Quercus, is where oaks lie, and it's broken down into two groups, into red oak group and white oak group.
Okay.
And that's based on the wood structure, leaf morphology, other characteristics. And red oak group is more susceptible due to the larger size of those vessels. Those water conducting pores are larger in red oak group.
I guess these are also, these are the oaks, just as for a layman, these are the oaks with the leaves with points on the ends of them. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So at the tip of the leaf, there will be a fine hair, a bristle-tipped hair, and you know usually they're pointed leaves. White oaks usually have rounded tip leaves.
Are the trees that are affected this year mainly on public or private land? Is that relevant?
It's a mixture of ownerships.
Okay.
Some of the ownerships and, you know, where oak wilt is found is on private lands, is lands owned by Consumers Energy, by Mayo Dam Pond. We have Mayo State Park that actually falls onto Consumers Energy ownership that the state leases. And so we have problems with oak wilt there because of the influx of campers and wood that's moving around through the state.
Can the wood of a diseased tree still be used for commercial purposes?
So this fungus is actually very intolerant of drying out. It's very intolerant of being dried out, and it doesn't tolerate competition from other wood rot fungi. So as a log is slabbed, you know, as it's being cut into boards, those slabs are cut off and usually chipped. And that renders that material useless to the fungus. The fungus cannot survive that drying process laying in a chip pile.
Okay. In terms of forest management, Deb McCullough, at what point do we humans start to interfere with natural selection and step in to act?
Well,
is there a threshold there? I guess that's my question.
Yeah, it kind of depends on your perspective there, I think. Oak wilt, there's a lot of evidence that it's not native to North America. It's probably one of these invasive problems that it came in at some point. Nobody paid attention to it until it started killing trees. So I'm not sure that we would say it's necessarily a natural thing. I think that we can, as people and the kinds of things that people do, we increase the likelihood that trees are going to become infected because we build houses in the middle of woods with oaks around them, and we cut roads or we cut sidewalks around oak trees. And now you're injuring the trees, you're stressing the trees, you're creating root wounds, that kind of thing. And all of that, you know, that's going to make the tree attractive to beetles and susceptible to things like oak wilt.
Ray Gurley, Michigan has a long-standing ban on transporting firewood. How well is it obeyed?
I would say the enforcement of that ban is very lax. It's hard. It's very difficult to enforce, and that's what I would say about that.
Deb, you're in agreement with that generally or not?
Well, I think in trying to enforce a ban right now, you're not supposed to take firewood from Lower Michigan into Upper Michigan, and that has to do with emerald ash borer and oak wilt and a number of different insects and pathogens that can be transported that way. Legally, you can move firewood, across Lower Michigan or across the UP. It's hard to regulate. I did this for years. My husband and I, if we were going camping or fishing or hunting, we would take some firewood, throw it in the truck because you never knew what you were going to find.
A lot of good people have done this over the years. We've had a long history. Before the awareness of this problem really became widely known, it was not a big deal.
It wasn't a big deal, and you think about a tree dies in the back of your house, you cut it down, you split it up, you put that firewood on top of the pile. Often that's the first wood that you grab when you're going up for 4th of July or whatever.
Right.
And things like oak wilt, the firewood won't transmit it for more than about a year. The old firewood is not the issue. It's the relatively fresh firewood. And it's just really hard to control. And I think most people, if they understand why it's not a good idea to move firewood, they'll do the right thing.
We've been talking about oak wilt disease, which is affecting much of the red oak forest in the northern Lower Peninsula. Ray Gurley is a forestry expert with Consumers Energy, and Deb McCullough is a professor of entomology here at Michigan State University. Ray, Deb, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mark.
Hey, thank you, Mark.
The newest Ken Burns documentary on PBS is entitled simply Jackie Robinson. It's an in-depth look at the life and times of the Brooklyn Dodgers star who was central to the integration of Major League Baseball in 1947. The program airs tonight and tomorrow night at 9 here on WKAR-TV. Here is filmmaker Ken Burns with a preview.
Jackie is the original civil rights pioneer. When Jackie broke the color line in baseball in 1947, Martin Luther King was a junior at Morehouse College. Harry S. Truman had not integrated the military. The Supreme Court had not ruled in Brown versus Board of Education that segregation was illegal. And Rosa Parks hadn't refused to give up her seat on the bus, as Jackie had done more than a decade before her in 1944, for which he got court-martialed at Fort Hood and won. Let me just quote Martin Luther King. Jackie Robinson was a sit-inner before sit-ins and a freedom rider before freedom rides. And that says it all. A lot of us talk a good talk. He actually walked the walk. He got up every day and tried to make things better. He said that we're only measured by the differences we make in the lives of other people.
Again, that's filmmaker Ken Burns. His documentary, Jackie Robinson, airs tonight and tomorrow night at 9 on WKAR-TV. Now, WKAR current sports host Al Martin also explores the impact Jackie Robinson had on an edition of Current Sports on the radio here on WKAR. This is coming up today, Al?
Right? It's actually a two-part series. Part one will air tonight on WKAR-TV, part two tomorrow. And on Current Sports Radio, we have the pleasure of welcoming actually Bob Kendrick, who is the president of the Negro League Baseball Museum out in Kansas City, Missouri. He's going to break down what exactly Jackie meant, not just to the sports world, as you just heard in that piece from Ken Burns there, Mark, just what he meant to society in general. So it should be a great time and a great chat with Bob.
There's an interesting spread in today's USA Today. Jackie Robinson's widow still lives. She is 93 years old, Rachel Robinson, and she is a part of the Ken Burns story here tonight, and she looks like and sounds like an incredible woman. I've seen her on television before, actually, in years past, but she is a part of the Ken Burns, of the Ken Burns production. Again, that's Jackie Robinson tonight and tomorrow night at 9 o'clock here on WKAR-TV. We are getting the baseball season started here all over Michigan as well. The
Lugnuts are, I should say, Mark.
We're trying. Well, yeah, we're not batting a thousand, so to speak.
Right, right.
Oh, forgive the pun. But Spartan baseball is off to a solid start. I guess we had to cancel the Tiger game yesterday, but MSU spring football has fans wondering what might be ahead for 2016 as well. Let's start there, actually. The biggest question for Spartan football might be who replaces Connor Cook. What's happening on that front?
Yeah, and I do want to preface it by saying this, Mark. I mean, it seems as though every time we talk about spring football, I mean, people get excited because naturally it's college football. But I want to say it is just the spring. There's so much that can change between the spring game, which takes place Saturday, April 23rd, and, of course, on the heels of the season, which begins September 2nd, I believe, against Furman. But when discussing that conversation, of course, Mark, as you just alluded to, that is the biggest question mark coming into this year. Who is going to replace Connor Cook, the most decorated quarterback in Michigan State football history? Now, D'Antonio has come out. Last week was the sixth spring practice that Michigan State wrapped up. In the media, we were allowed to go there and catch the first 10 minutes of it and talk to Coach D'Antonio. And before spring practice even began, D'Antonio announced that Tyler O'Connor is the number one quarterback as of right now going into the spring. Now, I do believe that Tyler O'Connor is the guy ahead in that race because when you look at his resume, I mean, if you remember last year, he started in place of Connor Cook, if right. you remember, in that 17-14 win over Ohio State. He was 7 of 12, 89 yards, even had 25 yards on the ground and threw for a touchdown. The other names in that race, though, Mark, that you can't ignore are Brian Lewerke, Messiah DeWeaver, alongside who I think is in the second slot right now to challenge O'Connor, Damian Terry. So that's the big question mark right now, but I will have to give the edge to Tyler O'Connor.
What about other key areas? Where are we strong? Where might we have some concerns?
Everywhere right now, Mark. Now, what I mean by that is there's a lot that will be missing from this squad this upcoming year that was with this squad last season. I mean, they're missing 20-plus seniors going into this upcoming year. Wide receiver, an interesting statistic. When you look at the wide receivers for this team last year, Mark, MSU, get this, they had five plays of 40 yards or more last season. All three of the passes that were 40 yards or more were to players that are no longer Spartans now. So they have to rebuild on that front. The offensive line is losing a lot of power on both sides, offensive line and defensive line. Right now in the OL, Brian Allen is the only preseason all-Big Ten candidate. The defensive line right now, I believe, lacks depth. Last season, six of the starters from last year's season got injured during from the start of the opening game to postseason play. So you got to stay healthy when it comes to that line. But when you talk about defensive tackles, Malik McDowell and Craig Evans, they will be the anchors of that defensive line, Mark. Really looking forward to how they play. And also running back. Now, running back, they have so much depth there, Mark. LJ Scott, he actually led the team in yardage last year. He had 146 carries for 699 yards and 11 touchdowns.
He's a freshman, right? Yes. So hopefully we've got LJ for a few more years.
Exactly. You got LJ, so he'll be a sophomore this upcoming year. Gerald Holmes, Madre London, and Delton Williams. He'll be the only senior out of that running back core. Looking forward to seeing him go out with the bang his senior season. So a lot of guys are leaving this team that were so instrumental to getting this team to the college football playoff last year. But I do believe that this team has so much talent coming in. And also, I didn't even mention who I believe is right now, he's probably been the most impressive. So I hear right now, keeping my ear close to spring practice, Donnie Corley from Detroit, incoming freshman. He has put on some plays and really put on a show throughout the first few scrimmages for this squad. Watch out for Donnie Corley at the wide receiver position, Mark.
Quite a spread on MSU wrestling coach Tom Minkle in yesterday's Lansing State Journal. Really a long story about a guy that maybe we don't know anywhere near as much about Minkle as we do about Tom Izzo and Mark D'Antonio, but still he's been around for a long time. A lot of people know him. He is retiring after heading the program for a quarter of a century. What do you think Tom Minkle's legacy will be?
Oh, boy. I mean, you talk about, 25 years, his coaching tenure starting back in 1991. And, we've had time multiple times on current sports radio and television. And I really liked Chris Solari's piece in the Lansing State Journal, because it profiled not just time as the coach. And, I mean, he's done anything that you can imagine that a wrestling coach can do at the Big Ten level. He's done it all. He's even coached at the Olympic level. But I really thought it was kind of cool, and we've had time to talk about this, that he's experienced so much just in his life. You know what I mean? I mean, I love this. Just to read this graph really quick here, Mark, this is what Chris Solari had to say in LSJ. That should come as no surprise. He's a man who witnessed the carnage of South American slaughterhouses, played music aboard cruise ships, taken part in international boycotts, and been thrown out of casinos. How about that? He's done that all.
Renaissance man.
Yeah, exactly, to say the least, right? Unbelievable. And he's going to be missed. He surely is going to be missed.
We are going to wish MSU wrestling coach Tom Minkle well, and we'll remind everybody that Current Sports with Al Martin airs every weekday at 1 p.m. on AM 870, and also look for Current Sports on TV with Al every week. Al Martin, thanks very much.
Hey, anytime, Mark. Thank you.
That's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, we've got our second Faces of Flint segment. We'll meet a family who's upset about the image of their city because of the water crisis. Jim, Joanne, and Maddie Herman point to developments and businesses they say are signs of vitality in Flint. That and more Monday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you could join us today. We'll be looking for you Tuesday. It's Current State on WKAR.